This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscow-Aim. In a speech yesterday, President Obama said the growing income divide between the rich and the poor was the defining challenge of our time that threatened the middle class and was an affront to the nation's values. One of the consequences, he said, was the erosion of economic mobility in this country.
The idea that so many children are born into poverty in the wealthiest nation on earth is heartbreaking enough. But the idea that a child may never be able to escape that poverty because she lacks a decent education or health care, or a community that views her future as their own, that should offend all of us. And it should compel us to action. We are a better country than this.
He called for an increase in the minimum wage, a greater investment in education, strengthening the safety net, extending jobless benefits for the long-term unemployed, revamping retirement, and help for distressed communities. He challenged his critics, namely Republicans in Congress, to offer their ideas to address these problems. We asked Michael Hirsch and Benjamin Applebaum to join us on Radio Times to get their reaction to this speech. Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for the National Journal, previously was the senior editor and national economics correspondent for Newsweek. And Michael Hirsch, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Benjamin Applebaum. He's Washington correspondent who covers business and economic topics for the New York Times. And nice to have you back with us as well.
Great to be here.
Benjamin, let me begin with you. Do you agree with the president that income inequality is the defining issue of our time?
Well, it's certainly a huge issue. It's something that has been unique to our era. We've seen this rapid growth in inequality, particularly over the last 15 years. The trend dates back a couple decades. Now it really started to accelerate over, say, the last 15 years. And there's really no precedent for it in American history for there to be this large a gap between the prosperity and rising wealth of that sort of top 1% of the population, or even if you want to cast it a little bit more broadly, the sort of the successful 5% of the population, and the real struggle of the middle class, which has actually lost ground in recent decades, families making less on average than they did a generation ago, which is something we've just never before seen in America. So it's new, it's really big, it has a lot of consequences. It's certainly something that deserves a lot of attention.
And Michael Hirsch, is picking up on that, the president's portrayal of the country yesterday, it's not the first time he has said all this. It's a pretty grim picture of the, not just the economic state of the country, but just the general future of the country.
Indeed. And, you know, one of the things the president didn't harp too much on is that, you know, for the last 5 years, or at least a good portion of that, it's basically been his economy. And during that time, income inequality has only grown. So this is something that, you know, is an issue that's very much at his doorstep. And to pick up on what Benjamin was saying, it's not just that these trends are new and perilous, it's that they're in danger of becoming locked in, if you will. We're in this slow growth period, what Obama's former economic advisor Larry Summers the other week called secular stagnation, which is almost like Japan. Very slow growth, monetary policy, you know, sort of running out of tools because you have very low interest rates, Congress paralyzed over fiscal policy, and no real fixes forthcoming. You know, there's a big debate right now over raising the minimum wage, and, you know, that will certainly help on the margins. But these are really drops in a very large bucket.
But are you saying, Michael, that this is the president's problem, and by that I mean he is to blame for this, and that his policies over the last 5 years helped to exacerbate this income inequality?
Well, certainly that is the conclusion of some of the economic work I've seen. Economist at the University of California, Berkeley, Emmanuel Saez, did a study a couple of years ago which showed that the wealthiest 1% of the country actually made out better in percentage terms during the Obama recovery period of 2009-2010 than they did from 2002 to 2007 under George W. Bush, even though, of course, Bush was the guy who, you know, put through the tax cuts which benefited the wealthy. So clearly, although Obama has embraced some policies, in particular Obamacare, which have sought to close these gaps, The overall results of his presidency are not really very impressive. I would not say that it's entirely Obama's fault. By no means is it. I mean, he inherited the worst financial downturn and recessionary period since the Great Depression. But there is a legitimate question to be raised about how effective his policies have been, particularly focused on the middle class, particularly when it comes to this defining issue, as he called it, income inequality.
I'm going to pick up on a bunch of things, but let me go back to you, Benjamin, and talk about the fact that today there are a bunch of rallies. Fast food workers are holding rallies, and there seems to be some popular support in this country for raising the minimum wage. As you're saying, it's around the margins. Do you see some movement on this issue?
Well, with specific regard to the minimum wage, I mean, poll after poll has shown that a majority of Americans support some form of increase in the minimum wage. It's important for listeners to understand that if you adjust for inflation, the minimum wage now is lower than it was two generations ago. So workers are able to buy less with the money they make than their grandparents could buy if they held comparable jobs. That, I think, is not consistent with the way many Americans want to see their country. It's not consistent with what many Americans appear to regard as fair. So there is, in fact, quite broad popular support for an increase in the minimum wage. The problem, if you are a person who thinks the minimum wage should be increased, is that Republicans in Congress oppose the idea. Mm-hmm. Republicans control the House, and there is little prospect that they're going to budge on the issue. So, you know, this, along with a number of other things on the president's list, are for the time being in the category of pipe dreams. And I think that that is a broader point that needs to be made. It is very difficult for me to understand a case that President Obama is himself responsible for the increase in income inequality in the United States. I think the only basis on which one could make that claim would be to point to specific policies that he is responsible for or has contributed to that have exacerbated income inequality. It's a much more interesting critique to talk about whether he's done anything to prevent or diminish income inequality, but to assign responsibility to him for the growth of income inequality, I confess I'm a little bit puzzled by that assertion.
Well, that puts the ball in your court. Michael Hirsch, go ahead.
Well, I agree with that assessment. I think it's much more important to point to things that Obama might have done but did not do. Clearly, the lion's share of his efforts, I mean, setting aside Obamacare, have focused on getting the financial sector back in shape. He has focused, on the bailouts for Wall Street, whereas his program for helping underwater mortgage holders since the 2008 crisis has been widely deemed to be insufficient. That's one contributing factor, clearly. One of the reasons that various studies have shown that the income inequality has grown during his tenure is because a lot of it is coming through higher stock prices. Stock markets back up, and that has tended to benefit the wealthiest, those who gain a lot of their income from the stock market. So I agree with Binion that it's not something that you can sort of blame Obama for squarely. I think that the real issue is, and here, of course, he has been restrained by Congress. There's no question about it, particularly when it came to the issue of a second fiscal stimulus. But I think the issue is, how much has he really been focused on these particular issues, in particular income inequality, during his presidency?
Well, and let me throw something else out here. Benjamin, I'll go back to you. And the president touted the numbers of jobs that have been created since he's been president, I think 7 or 8 million jobs. But we're learning, as you dig deeper, that many of these jobs are low-paying jobs. I'm looking at a report from the University of California, Berkeley, calculated that almost a third of all bank tellers receive some form of government assistance.
With specific respect to job creation, I mean, I think we can just say flatly that job creation in recent years has been pathetic and tragically short of our needs, and we are in an absolutely terrible state. And the president can stand up there and cite how many millions of jobs have been created, but the reality is that the share of American adults who have jobs has not increased since the recession and is at the lowest level in modern history. So there has been effectively no recovery in the labor market. And what's even worse, as you note, is that we've seen a shift toward lower wage work. To the extent that we are creating jobs, they tend primarily to be the kinds of jobs where the minimum wage is a really relevant consideration. It's a really big problem. And this is separate from the question of, what more could the president have done or who is responsible for that situation. But the notion that our labor market is improving or functioning or serving the needs of America, it's not true.
Well, and Michael, the president talked about the mobility rate in this country being like Jamaica's or Argentina.
Yeah, look, I mean, it all goes back to the same problem. We have this growing inequality problem that transcends presidencies, certainly dates back to George W. Bush's at the least. In fact, the last time in recent decades that we saw across the board income growth was the late 90s during the Clinton era. That is a problem that is being, it seems, locked in because there are no solutions to really kick growth back up again. I mean, again, a lot of these solutions that Obama is talking about, has alluded to, mentioned in his speech yesterday, the minimum wage, more job programs, education, particularly for low-income people, these will all help, but largely on the margins.
And is that because just we're talking about structural, systemic problems within our economy, Michael?
Well, in part, you have a financial crisis that was so severe that we are still dealing with a kind of, you know, national post-traumatic stress syndrome coming out of that, if you will. I mean, you have an unwillingness to lend on the part of the banking sectors. You have a lot of people feeling snakebit about the huge amount of debt they took on during, you know, the housing bubble. Many of them, of course, still underwater in some sense. So you don't have a lot of spending, and if you don't have a lot of spending, you're not going to have, investment and jobs. And that is partly the fault of this crisis that was historic in its dimensions. There's a very well-known book by Ken Rogoff of Harvard and Carmen Reinhardt that sort of traced back 800 years of financial history and showed that, you know, the downturns that result from an economic, a financial crash, I should say, are almost always more severe and take far longer to come out of. So to a certain extent, in that respect, perhaps it's nobody's fault, except for possibly Wall Street.
I can think of a few people, but yes.
Yeah, those who allowed the bubble and the securitization mania to go on. But what I'm saying is that to a certain extent, this just may be a long, slow growth period that was pre-cooked because of the nature of the financial crisis.
Well, let's take a very short break. And Benjamin, I want to get you back in on the conversation. I'm sure you have things to say about that as well. We are talking about the income inequality, the growing income inequality gap, something that President Obama spoke about yesterday at a speech. He said it poses a fundamental threat to the American dream. Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. Benjamin Applebaum, Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He covers business and economic topics. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@WHYY.org, or send me a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
Flashpoint Theater supports WHYY and presents David Sedaris' The Santaland Diaries, adapted by Joe Mantello, December 11th through the 23rd. For 10 years running, Flashpoint's Santaland Diaries brings Sedaris' lovable, curmudgeonly crumpet, the Macy's Elf, to life, making audiences laugh until they cry. Flashpoint Theater is located on Sansom Street, two blocks from the Avenue of the Arts. For tickets, 267-997-3312 or flashpointtheater.com.
Getting ready to put your lawnmower to bed for the winter? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a look at whether you should make the last cut a low one to prevent snow mold, plus invasive plants and sustainable landscapes, and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Yeah. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, musician Ben Folds on why he is no Simon Cowell when it comes to judging contestants on The Sing-Off.
I want the next time to be even better. And I don't think that you achieve that by telling them what they can't do or really overemphasizing what they did wrong.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Michael Hirsch and Benjamin Applebaum and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Benjamin, going back to what Michael was saying right before the break, and also even going back to the president's speech yesterday, he talked about Abraham Lincoln, he talked about Teddy Roosevelt, FDR and Social Security, he talked about LBJ for Medicare and Medicaid. These, of course, all government programs to help out people in need in this country. Has the government run out of tools to help people in need today?
Well, that's a great question. It gets to something that I found really striking about the president's speech yesterday. 2 years ago in Osawatomie, Kansas, he gave a very similar speech in which he talked about inequality. This was during his reelection campaign. He talked about inequality as a defining issue of our time. He laid out the problem in terms very similar to the terms that he used yesterday. But what was striking about that speech were the solutions that he offered. The two major powers that government has are the powers of taxing and spending. And those two powers have a lot to say about the extent of inequality in our society. The way that we collect taxes can be a major force to push back against inequality. If we collect taxes at higher rates from the wealthy, it offsets some of the inequality in the economy. And the way that we spend money can be a huge offset to inequality. When we invest in education, in science research, in infrastructure, we can help the economy to develop, help people to develop, and build an economy that is capable of providing a better quality of life for people. And those were prominent themes in that address 2 years ago. And they were substantially absent from the president's speech yesterday. And it reflects the degree of his impotence, because both taxes and spending policy are things that he needs to negotiate with Congress, things that ultimately rest in the hands of Congress, and Congress at present is substantially dysfunctional. So it is the case that if one is asking, can the government do something about inequality, I think the answer is clearly yes. Government has substantial power to do big things about inequality. Do I foresee that government is going to do anything about inequality in the near future? No, it's going to be more of this gridlock that we've seen. And that, again, in yesterday's speech, you saw that reflected in the types of solutions that the president offered. He talked about the need for lower-income kids to get enrolled in college, and he announced that he would be summoning some university presidents to the White House to make an announcement about, you know, them while working with him. He talked about the need for the long-term unemployed to get hired, and he announced that he'd be bringing corporate executives to the White House to talk to them. This is a president who's trying desperately to figure out who else he can work with if he can't work with Congress.
But are you saying that Congress is bad for the economy?
I don't think there's any question that Congress is bad for the economy. The way that they have conducted or not conducted the nation's fiscal policy in recent years has been a large and significant drag on this economic recovery. Many economists regard it as the single largest negative to economic growth in recent years.
How do you see it, Michael?
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. He is basically paralyzed because of Congress, because of the ideology that continues to predominate. The smaller government is better ideology. But, you know, look, change could come in unseen ways. I mean, I personally, since I just finished up an article on her, think that Janet Yellen's ascension to Federal Reserve chairwoman could make a big difference. She represents a more progressive way of economic thinking than we've seen in recent Fed chiefs. If you look at her work as an academic and talking with a lot of her former colleagues, she's passionate about the unemployment issue, about addressing it in some way. Fed chairmen often have an influence that goes beyond the strict limits of monetary policy in terms of shaping the debate. We saw that, for example, with Alan Greenspan during his tenure of 18 years when, you know, he basically pushed for the deregulation of banking in Wall Street. We saw Ben Bernanke, nominally a conservative economist, basically turn the Federal Reserve into, you know, this major activist fount of buying in order to prevent another Great Depression, which was sort of his great passion as a scholar of the Great Depression. So, you know, it's very possible that Janet Yellen, although she's obviously been very careful in what she's been saying up to now because she has not yet been confirmed, right. Could help to alter the debate, could help to push for policies like a minimum wage, you know, and make that a more realistic prospect than it looks right now. But, you know, where we are right now is just not a very good place. And indeed, the Obama administration has largely allowed the Republican-controlled House to continue to dictate set the agenda, if you will, in terms of the sequester being accepted and so forth.
With the advantage of hindsight and, of course, rolling back the clock, what could the president have done, for instance, about the sequester, Michael?
Well, I'm not sure that there's much he could have done. I mean, he clearly was surprised when the special committee that was set up in order to avoid the sequester right. failed to come to any agreement. But, you know, it's striking, I think, that in September, before this latest shutdown battle began, the White House essentially announced that it, you know, would be okay with a House Republican spending bill that kept government funding at at the current levels, as long as the language that would have defunded Obamacare was taken out. That was a signal that the president has kind of given up, I think, on trying to turn back this tide, and it's not very promising for the future.
Well, and let me go back to you, Benjamin, and I'm thinking about even those photographs we've seen of LBJ essentially arm twisting members of Congress. How FDR was able to get those programs through his Congress when he was president. Is there something this president isn't doing to get some of these programs and ideas through Congress?
Yeah, you know, this is a really lively debate about the extent to which presidential persuasion is a real thing and is a functional and effective thing. And I don't know that I know who's right in that great debate.
Right.
You know, Obama clearly has not been as forceful as some of his predecessors. Whether he would have been more successful if he were more forceful is a hypothetical that I don't know the answer to. But I do think that there have been missed opportunities. And one is something that Michael mentioned earlier, and I think he's exactly right about, and that is housing. This administration made a conscious decision not to do very much about the housing crisis, not to try to help people who are losing their homes. It did it for a variety of reasons that are interesting to explore, but the bottom line is that they put into place a very anemic and broken program to help people facing foreclosure. Those are the people who are struggling with income inequality. Those are the losers in this equation. That was a real opportunity. The administration had the money, it had the political will, it had the votes in Congress, and it chose not to press the issue. And I know that at least some people in the administration and outside of it look back on that with a great deal of regret. There's also a lively discussion about whether the administration should have sought a larger stimulus package in the early months of its tenure. So now President Obama is saddled with a Republican Congress, and it's very easy to look at the situation and say his hands are substantially tied. Even if he went to them and was as forceful as LBJ, Republicans have absolutely no incentive to deal with him, and there's little prospect that they're going to agree to do the things that he wants them to do. All eyes are on the midterm elections. But I think the real questions concern whether this administration understood the severity of our economic problems in its first term and whether it responded with sufficient force to the reality of those problems.
And that's Benjamin Applebaum, Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He covers business and economic topics. Also with us, Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. We are talking about the president's speech yesterday, in which he talked about the income gap and the problem of the lack of economic mobility in this country. He did lay out some ideas to deal with those issues, but as we have been talking about, not much traction on those ideas. And I do want to get to some callers at 1-888-477-9499. But I just want to toss out one more thing. And I, to be perfectly honest with you, I worry about the fact that there's so many people in this country. I think the president said yesterday half of the country has been poor at some point in their life. If we're a country and economy that relies on consumer spending, but people don't have money to spend, you know, we're not going to have the kind of economy that's going to lead to the kind of mobility that we've been talking about. Benjamin, you want to just respond to that?
I think there's two components of it that are really interesting. The first is the assumption that we should have the kind of economy that rests on consumer spending. That certainly has been the engine of our growth in the last few decades. It may be an unhealthy engine. Part of our problem may be that we have relied so completely on consumer spending that we are no longer the export powerhouse that we once were, that we, you know, have seen a real decline in business investment or a shift in business investment to foreign countries. It may be that we need to reorient our growth model and find ways of encouraging, you know, things, encouraging the manufacturing of things in America or services at the very least that we can export to the rest of the world and rest a little bit less heavily on consumption. But in the short term, we are consumption dependent, and this gets right back to inequality because, you know, one of the great things that seems to be afflicting our economy right now is even as we see incremental increases in prosperity, even as growth picks up a little bit, much of that gain is being distributed to the wealthy. And economists use a fancy term for this. They call it the marginal propensity to spend. But what it basically means is that if you put another dollar in a rich person's pocket, they're not going to spend it. They already have the things that they need. They're going to save it or sit on it or do something else with it, but they're not going to go out to a fancier dinner. They're already at the fanciest restaurant. Right. And so this is really a problem with our economic model, is that we lack a mechanism right now for getting that money into the hands of the people who would spend it and who need it and who are desperate to spend it. And that's really a catch-22 for this economic recovery.
You want to comment on that, Michael, and then we'll get to our callers.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And the solutions to problems like those are, as Benjamin suggested earlier, dramatic restructuring of the tax code, for example, to make it more progressive so that you do begin to distribute income more fairly across the board and to the middle class who will spend more. But the political paralysis in Washington has made that all but impossible.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Sarah from Haddonfield, New Jersey, joining us on Radio Time. Sarah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I haven't heard any discussion about the weakening of antitrust laws, and I feel like I see so many monopolies growing, and the small business person doesn't have a chance to get a loan or be successful in competition with this. And what happened to the antitrust laws, and do you think this is a factor in the economic inequality that's going on?
Sarah, let me toss that to Michael. Do you want to take that first?
Well, I haven't actually followed.
Or do you want me to toss that to Benjamin?
Yeah, that's better.
You want to take that, Benjamin?
So, you know, I'm not sure if the call is referring to some specific weakening in antitrust laws, but it is the case that we've seen increased economic concentration across a wide range of industries. We've seen it, you know, prominently in the airline industry in recent years. We've seen the growth of really large banks. Economists have there's a big debate about how connected this is to economic inequality. There are economists who are very concerned about economic inequality, but do not view this as particularly a factor, because large firms can be more efficient, they can pay higher wages, they can provide goods at lower cost to consumers, they can provide a lot of benefits for lower-income workers as well. One area where it has seemed to contribute is in the wages and benefits that these corporations pay to their executives. The easiest example of this is Walmart. You know, you once had a nation in which, you know, a shopkeeper in each city was realizing the benefits of the profits from the sale of dry goods. You now have a system in which the Walton family realizes a disproportionate share of the profits of the sale of dry goods in every American city. That's inequality in a nutshell. You've got one family now reaping the profits substantially of what was once a diversified and fragmented business. So in that sense, there may be a contribution, but the overall economic consequences are pretty complicated to untangle.
And just picking up on that, no, go ahead, Michael.
I would just add, a company, Walmart, that you know, pays its employees very little, indeed to the point where many of them can't afford to shop at Walmart, hence some of these protests. So that also, I think, encapsulates part of the problem here.
And I was just going to add to that, and depending on government programs in order to help pay their bills. Thanks for the call, Sarah. Let me see what Paul from Levittown has to say. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Molly. Hi there. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I just wanted to kind of put my thought about it. Remember when Obama took office, the American car industry was just about to implode, was just about bankrupt. And some policies of his saved it, that's a lot of jobs, not just the factories, but also dealerships and parts and repair and so forth. But there has been an awful lot of union busting, offshoring of manufacturing, use of robots. And so I feel like industry has become more profitable. The stock market is really high, and I think that might just be because general business practices have made things more profitable, and I don't think business wants to become less profitable. And I guess I just see it as much more something that comes under the control of economic forces that are understood and manipulated by people who really know their business stuff. They went to Harvard Business School and so forth, rather than government policy.
Well, let me pick. You raise a couple of things. I want to take the car industry example, and Michael, if I can toss that, does President Obama get some credit for that?
Certainly. As you know, that was a huge issue during the 2012 presidential campaign with Mitt Romney and the Republicans having come out against the auto bailout. One must conclude that it was largely successful and probably necessary. Mm-hmm. So, again, you did save a lot of jobs. But again, these are not policies that are going to structurally and profoundly change the direction of the country. They certainly did help to save the American auto industry at that particular moment in time.
Benjamin, I was actually at an event last night, and someone from the manufacturing industry was talking actually about here in Philadelphia, saying that there are something like 500 manufacturing jobs that are ready and open and ready to be filled, but the difficulty of finding people with the kind of skills to fill those jobs. Do you think that's a national problem?
It is a problem, and it is a growing problem, because you have a problem of critical mass. You know, if North Carolina is a good example of this. If you have a state where there's a concentration of the textile industry, people grow up thinking about working in the textile industry. There are programs to train them. When companies come looking for them, there's a critical mass of available workers. As those companies begin to close and move overseas, and you've just got a smattering of them, those jobs are less visible, those opportunities are less apparent, kids are less likely to seek work in those industries. It becomes a real problem to sustain a small manufacturing base and to find the workers that you need. But I want to, if I can, go back to something that last caller said that's really important. One of the most striking current economic statistics is that if you look at what companies do with their money, the share of their money that goes to wages as opposed to profit payouts to their shareholders is at the lowest level in modern history. Companies are paying a smaller share of their earnings as wages than at any other time in modern American history. And that really, to me, is one number that just encapsulates this problem. You can talk about it as the Walmart effect if you want. I mean, Michael's right that you've got this duality of incredibly good profits and incredibly low wages. It's happening across industries. It's happening across the economy. Workers are having a really hard time gaining traction. And the caller mentioned one possible explanation, which is the decline of the union movement. There are others. Globalization is clearly a big and related factor. But getting our hands around why that is happening, why workers are having such a hard time securing their share of the value of the goods and services that they produce, really seems to me to be at the very core of this question.
And we're almost up in a break here. And Michael, the president talked about how high productivity has grown in the last couple of decades, but wages have really not kept up with that.
No, that's right. And what Benjamin was just saying is a critically important point. I mean, one example, or I should say, what sort of symbolizes the growing income inequality is the difference between what CEOs have been paying themselves and what they give to their workers in wages. I mean, some of this goes back to tax policies and corporate Wall Street friendly corporate policies that basically gave executives a huge portion of options as part of their salary, and so they benefited when the stock market did and their workers didn't. But that's an unfixed problem.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Michael Hirsch, also with us, Benjamin Applebaum, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, supports WHYY and is accepting clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute has served the region since 1994 by providing treatment for psychological challenges, including depression, anxiety, and stress. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020. Thank you.
For decades, the police, the FBI, and others in law enforcement have used interrogation techniques that some scientists and legal scholars say are based on outdated science and psychology and can produce false confessions. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Douglas Starr, who writes about interrogation techniques in the current edition of The New Yorker. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Happy meals, unhappy workers. Fast food workers protesting in 100 cities around the country demanding $15 an hour. Next time on the program, if you want to live Moss, maybe workers need to be paid Moss. Fast food and workers' demands on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In a speech yesterday, President Obama declared that income inequality is the defining issue of our time. He said the income gap is bad for the economy, bad for families, bad for democracy, and hurts mobility. Talking about what this all means with Benjamin Applebaum, who covers business and economics for The New York Times, and Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. And we have lots of phone calls or phone callers at 1-888-477-9499. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet me at Marty Moss Cohen. We do have an email from JB wanting to know whether either of you could address the politics of race and how this has led to disparity and impeded progress. Obama mentioned race and some other issues yesterday. Do you see this as a factor as part of our conversation today, Michael?
Yeah, unfortunately, it still is, because the economic data show that African Americans continue to dramatically underperform whites, as do Hispanics. So you do have these dramatic racial disparities that show up consistently. And of course, you know, it's been an undercurrent of racism, I think, has to some extent afflicted the debate in Washington. I think a number of commentators have suggested that part of the conservative Republican resistance to Obamacare is not so much, partly it's about they don't like anything Obama proposes, but it's also because this is, in effect, an income redistribution to the lower classes of Americans who tend to be African American and Hispanic.
The kind of makers and takers argument?
Exactly.
Benjamin, you want to weigh in on that?
Just briefly, you know, I think the president tried to do something interesting yesterday, which was to reframe discussions about race as discussions about class. He brought up a couple of statistics noting that, you know, gaps between economic classes in America are now larger than gaps between, you know, blacks and whites on average, for example. And this reflects the reality that we've seen, that there is now a large black middle class. Many black families have successfully, you know, transition from poverty to middle class or even affluent status in this country. And what we've seen increasingly is a bifurcation of racial groups, you know, that has left behind a significant portion of the population. And in trying to sort of get away from these race conversations, I think he's trying to basically say to people, listen, this is a contentious issue. Let's set it aside and talk about the economic issues purely. The risk there is the possibility, in many people's view, the reality that race is a major reason why at least some people are stuck at the bottom of the economic ladder. And if you're not talking about it, it becomes a lot harder to solve.
Let me see what Ciro from Westchester has to say. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
You are a national treasure.
Oh,
here's
thank you
my
so
comment.
Much.
The U.S. government provided jobs during World War II, and this helped get the U.S. out of the Depression. Why not do the same thing now, except instead of spending the money on war material, we spend it on the infrastructure? Your comments.
Thank you for calling into Radio Times. That's something the president talked about yesterday, and governors have talked about infrastructure. We just passed some bills here in Pennsylvania to deal with our infrastructure problems. Michael, how important is that, do you think, for the overall functioning and economy of the country, and even for jobs?
Well, it is critically important. You have a deteriorating infrastructure. You don't have a lot of spending on it. But once again, you have to break through this ideological paralysis in Washington, dominated by a Republican Party that, dating from from the Reagan years continues to resist additional tax hikes of any kind and it makes it much more difficult to plow money into that. I mean, getting back to the World War II analogy, the caller is exactly right. It was really World War II and the supplying of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of jobs to people, to men who became soldiers and to others who joined the war industry, that really brought the nation finally out of that Great Depression. Mm. But we don't have the equivalent of a war, nor do we want one in particular. And so you don't have the kind of political mobilization that you had after Pearl Harbor, for example.
Benjamin, the president talked about, and I've heard other people say, the government borrowing today is at historic low points. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on how you count. The government, in absolute terms, the amount of money that the government is borrowing is clearly larger than it's ever been before, but our economy is also larger than it's ever been before. And if you compare those two, we sort of commonly talk about the scale of it as being massive and incomprehensible, but in truth, mm-hmm. relative to the size of the economy, it's really not that bad at all. The problem is twofold. First, we've done the same thing in a lot of past years, and so we have this accumulated burden of debt that's pretty substantial. And the even larger problem is that going forward, we've made a lot of promises to take care of people as they age, to provide medical care for them, to provide stipends for them. The projections are that we can't sustain those promises on current mm-hmm. terms, and that's where we really need to start worrying about the level of our borrowing. So it's true structurally that what we're doing today is not per se problematic. We have a long-term problem that needs to be addressed at some point.
So were the 50s an aberration? Benjamin?
It's a great question, and it gets a lot of debate. We look back at that era of prosperity and rapid growth, and, one possible explanation for the 1950s is that they were the payback for the 1930s, that the devastation that we inflicted on ourselves in the 1930s left, for example, a lot of good ideas on the table that nobody had the money to fund. And when we finally got done, wrecking our own economy and having a war and got back to work, there were all these great ideas sitting around that people were able to pick up and put into practice, and we had an economic boom as a consequence. And so the 50s were an aberration in the sense that, they were sort of rocket-fueled by an unusually bad decade. The better question is whether, say the 60s or other eras in which we've seen, steady, a little bit less than spectacular growth, but still much stronger growth than we have right now, is there anything that prevents us structurally from getting back to that kind of growth? Is there anything, that consigns us to this current malaise? Or can we do better than this?
I'd be curious what you think about that, Michael, then we'll get back to our callers.
Well, there are a lot of complicated issues here going back again to the aftermath of a historically bad financial crash. But also, and I guess I keep coming back to this point because I think it's critical, it's the ideology of the times. I mean, our present zeitgeist is still a sort of Reaganite small government one. It was very different in the 50s and 60s. You had a much more Keynesian view of the economy, a much more tolerance on both sides of the aisle toward government activism and government programs. Of course, had most famously LBJ's, war on poverty and, in Medicare and Medicaid in the 60s, things that if you look at the ideological environment today, would seem to be almost but impossible to enact, and look at the difficulty, as an example, of that Obama had in pushing through Obamacare, even though it was a historic achievement, because going back to the Clinton years and the infamous Hillary care program, no president had succeeded in that. Nonetheless, he had to make a lot of compromises.
Let me see what looks like Nick from Temple University has to say. And Nick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm heartened to hear this discussion on economic inequality, and it's becoming more prevalent. I wanted to point out that wealth inequality, which is related, but wealth inequality is a great deal higher than economic inequality, than income inequality. And I was wondering what you think about the idea of having a wealth tax, as many European countries do, and taking some of these excess profits and channeling them back into jobs and education opportunities and income supplements for the lower classes.
I guess wealth meaning people's assets beyond just what they make as an income.
Yes, because I believe that even though income is very unevenly distributed, it's something like the top 1% of Americans have almost half of the national wealth in stocks, bonds, properties, et cetera?
Sure. No, I think it's an interesting question. Benjamin, can I toss that back at you?
So we do have some kinds of wealth taxes. Property taxes are a kind of wealth tax. The other really big one is the estate tax, which is a tax on wealth at the time of death. And the estate tax has been reduced. It's been a major focal point for Republicans to drive down the level of estate taxation. They feel very strongly that wealth that a family accrues, it should be able to retain and pass on to its next generation. So it's an ideologically fraught issue. The bottom line is it is possible to tax wealth. It's very controversial to do it. Any form of revenue generation, any form of increased revenue generation from wealthier Americans, whether it's a tax on their income or on their wealth, will tend to lean against income inequality. And it's important in that context to note that we are doing less of that than we've done in a very long time. If you look at the share of income that the wealthy pay in taxes, it has absolutely plummeted in recent decades. The shift in the tax burden is one of the sort of most striking trends in the way our government interacts with our society. We are increasingly leaning on the middle class to carry the cost of government. The wealthy have benefited from that. It is clearly a factor that is exacerbating income inequality. And in one form or another, if you think that inequality is a problem, you need to start talking about tax policy.
Well, would a wealth tax make it through Congress, Michael Hirsch?
No chance. And everything Benjamin just said is exactly right. And I think it's the crux of the problem. You just don't have the environment that will allow that. Indeed, it's all been going in the opposite direction, not just the estate tax, also capital gains tax breaks that for a long time now have benefited the wealthiest and benefited, you know, investment income, which all contributes to this income inequality problem. The burden, it has been on the middle class. And the middle class, after the bursting of the housing bubble, found itself unable to cope. And I think, in a nutshell, that's our problem.
I'm getting very, very depressed having our... I mean, I'm enjoying this conversation.
Well, it's a depressing subject.
It is a depressing subject. And we called you up, the two of you up, to talk about it. I mean, are there, you know, not to be a total Pollyanna about this, but do you see any bright spots, Michael Hirsch?
Well, I would just repeat, and perhaps this is really Pollyannish to expect much out of Janet Yellen, certainly not right away, certainly not at a time when the Federal Reserve's traditional tools have been so curtailed in their effectiveness. But I do think, having studied her record and talked to a lot of people who've worked with her over the years, that she brings a fresh set of economic views to this city that kind of harks back to some of the old, what these to be known as a hydraulic Keynesian views, which is that you can actually affect the economy with the right kind of government intervention. And even though she may not be able to influence the debate right away, the fact is that the chairman of the Federal Reserve is so powerful, I mean, it's said to be like the second most powerful job in Washington after the president, that perhaps she can help to change the debate. One of the things one finds is that she's almost as popular among Republicans as she is among Democrats, not all of them. Some of the far-right ones, the so-called dollar hawks, are opposed to her nomination. But most people speak fairly highly of her, and she's someone who has proven in the past to be very persuasive. So I'm hoping that the Yellen era at the Fed could help to change the ideological paralysis problem a little bit.
Benjamin, any bright spots for you?
Yeah, I think there's two things that are changing in our political dynamics that have at least the potential to help us address these problems. The first is that we've seen a shift. It's happened first in the Republican Party. It's happening now in the Democratic Party. A recentering of the recentering is the wrong word, but a shift in the political priorities of the party to focus much more acutely on the concerns of its middle class members. In the Republican Party, that was the Tea Party movement. It is primarily a movement of middle class families that feel disenfranchised, that feel impotent, that feel angry about their economic situation. They've really forced the Republican Party to focus on those concerns. They've adopted a platform that, has ended up at loggerheads with the Obama administration's platform, but it's an interesting shift. Mm-hmm. And we are now seeing the same thing happening in the Democratic Party. Elizabeth Warren is an avatar of this change. Janet Yellen is an instance of it. These are people who have a very different view of how the economy works than the centrist Clinton-Obama paradigm that has prevailed for the last two decades. And, I am a believer that sometimes when you get contention, when you have the two parties sharply at odds, you also get some clarity and perhaps even some movement. And I think it could potentially be helpful for the two parties to start shouting at each other about middle-class economic issues. There is at least the potential that they'll start finding things that they agree about in that type of exchange. And then the other thing that is changing that is really important, and President Obama mentioned it yesterday, is that it is a lot easier to address these kinds of issues when the pie is growing. And there is at least the prospect that our economy, after this long period of malaise, will start to grow a little bit more quickly next year. A lot of economists expect it to happen. And if that does happen, it begins to create a moment of opportunity for us. It's the type of moment when it might be possible to think about, you know, what we want to do with that additional pie. And there's at least the hope. And, you know, I regret sounding too hopeful even as I'm doing this, because in general I'm pretty pessimistic about our ability to deal with our problems. But if you wanted to make the case that there's a reason for optimism, it would lie in the fact that our political dynamics are changing and our economic situation is starting to brighten just a little bit, and that might create an opening for progress.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here, I'm just going to paraphrase one of our callers, Wallace from Doylestown. Could they comment on what appears to be the reality that the very wealthy control our politicians? Is that correct, Michael?
Well, you have had this very powerful Wall Street-Washington nexus, which again goes back to the problem of the the financial crisis of 2008. You certainly have a very, very well-moneyed and powerful Wall Street lobby, so that has been a problem. But again, alluding to what we were just saying, between Janet Yellen and Elizabeth Warren, who's claiming this populist banner in the Democratic Party, who's going to force Hillary Clinton, if she runs, to move left, you do have the possibility of a shift of opinion against this dominant structure. So who knows?
Well, my thanks, in spite of my complaints about how depressing this was, my thanks to both of you very much for joining us today in Radio Times. Michael Hirsch, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And he's chief correspondent for National Journal. And Benjamin Applebaum, thank you very much as well.
In an odd way, I enjoyed it.
I did too, as well. I know, I guess we're kind of weird. He's Washington correspondent for the New York Times, covers business and economic topics. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Twitter, Facebook, email, archives, podcasts, satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Jessica Crocker, our intern for today. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.